Soul Star Order, defenders of justice and truth, have been ambushed by the evil magicians, the Direites.
This is the world of the Micronauts, a Croyer, the enemy, and the Micronaut Space Warriors, all sold separately.
Discover Planet of the Apes.
The Shogun Warriors. Guy King with rocket boosters. Great Mazinga with rocket launcher.
Look! Godzilla!
Is he friend or foe? You can decide.
Wow.
Launch his claw. Imagine his breath is a blast of fire.
Welcome to the House of Licensed Ideas, episode number 5. How are you, buddy?
Yeah, I'm fine. Thanks, Billy, man. We're back talking about Marvel's licensed properties, ROM. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got a great Godzilla issue for you patrons out there. We've also got a fantastic Micronauts issue. And can't wait to get to it. So, yeah, I haven't been doing much, just, enjoying the onset of October. And I know you're also gearing up for that, Mr. B.
Oh, yeah. Love this time of year. It's my favorite. And can't wait. Every year, can't wait for it.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. This is, I mean, between you and I, personally, the most podcasts we've ever recorded and edited in a 2 or 3 month span ever, I think.
Probably.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not counting Into the Weird and then World on Fire, and then, of course, we've got the new show, Star Rocket Radio, and then we've also got the Halloween episodes we already pre-recorded for Magazines and Monsters, and, I've got a Long Box of Darkness episode on the back burner. And you've got, and we've got Into the Weird, the patron episode. So, damn, man, I've never recorded this much in my entire life. but it's fun.
Yeah.
I'm not planning to stop anytime soon. Yeah. So, Billy, we'll kick it off with our favorite, of course, ROM. Although this might not be my favorite issue this time around, even though it's pretty damn great. It's our favorite Marvel licensed property between you and me, I'm thinking. Except for Conan, maybe. But, I mean, of the show that we're doing, House of Licensed Ideas, ROM is definitely way up there. And, we've got some details to give, of course, concerning this particular issue. This is specifically ROM number 5, and it was cover dated April 1980 and on sale January the 15th of 1980. And the cover art's by Al Milgram, and writer Bill Mantlo, artist Sal Buscema, lettered by Michael Higgins, colored by George Russo's, and the title is A House is Not a Home. So we'll see what that means, as Rom, Brandy, and Steve are in this house on the cover, battling these supernatural occurrences. There's got a bit of Lovecraft in there. There's got a poltergeist feel to it as well, with with all the furniture flying around. It's great.
Yeah, you better believe it. This is a good one. It's crazy, but it's good.
Insane, man. So, Billy, you're up first. What is your Twitter-style synopsis for ROM number 5?
After ROM takes out Archie Stryker, Brandy, Steve, and ROM take off with the race blasting away at them. ROM then flies them to an abandoned house for some rest. But inside we see Doctor Strange.
Oh yeah, bring on the doc. Hey, that's a great synopsis. Very succinct. I love it. Yeah, this is a Doctor Strange connection for you here, listeners, because Doctor Strange is going to fight a very old villain, originally encountered by Doctor Strange in Strange Tales number 120, I think it is. So, this is going to be it was a great issue, and I should say not really in line with what's happening in the story, per se. This is sort of feels like a placeholder kind of issue, but there are some Dire Wraith action happening here. And, of course, this creature that ROM battles is actually here as a result of the Dire Wraith's machinations, right, Billy?
Right. This is crazy.
Oh, it's so crazy, man. All right, so my synopsis is as follows. As the Wraiths recover the broken body of Firefall, ROM, Steve, and Brandy take shelter in an abandoned house and find themselves menaced by an ancient demon formerly banished to Limbo by Doctor Strange, the dire machinations of the Wraiths in issue 3 freed this demon, and now it's Space Knight's science versus hell-spawned sorcery. Yeah, that's it.
Oh, yeah.
So, Billy Man, it picks up from where we left off in the last issue, right after Rom defeated Archie Stryker, who's now Firefall, right?
Yep.
And then, you know, speak on this. Well, let's first talk cover. You know, we can first talk about the cover. What do you think about Al Milgram here putting some horror, injecting some much-needed horror for this October into this cover?
It's pretty good. You know, it's not one of my favorites of the series, but it's pretty good. I can't really, you know, beat on it too bad or anything like that here. I enjoy it. It's, you know, got Rom struggling with some creature that's, you know, off the panel here or off the page with Brandy and Steve in the background cowering. But the only thing I would say about it is when I look at it, I'm like, you look at the background in the right-hand side, it almost looks like they're in prison. Like
yeah, exactly.
Bars on the windows.
It looks like this bar. It's a it almost looks like a dungeon or a Tower of London type jail, like you say. You know,
yeah.
It doesn't look like a house, but the furniture though is very, you know, I'd say 19th century type. You know, so except for this, what appears to be an electric lamp in a flower pot. No, it's actually just a lamp. You know, being shattered against Rom. But you know, this made me think of that old H.P. Lovecraft tale, "The Dreams in the Witch House." You know, I mean, the cover just screams that, because you've got this Lovecraftian monstrosity with these tentacles grabbing a hold of Rom, and then you've also got these, furniture pieces battering Rom. So there's a mix of about everything in here. And this is interesting. Yeah. The title on the cover is not "A House is Not a Home." Like the interior title, it's "The House That Haunted Space Knights," which is weird. And then they even tease a special guest appearance by Doctor Strange. Nope, not, I mean, technically, maybe, but not really. It's just, he saw Doctor Strange in a dream vision or of the past or something. And then Sal Buscema brings the awesome with right from the first page. Wow. Speak on that, Billy.
Yeah, this splash page is great. It shows, in the forefront you have Rom, and then he's standing tall but behind like a tree for some cover, and you have Brandy and Steve that are kind of cowering beneath him, and to the left is cops everywhere looking for Rom, and of course the Wraiths that are there, you know, in disguise. They also are looking for Brandy and Steve, because if you remember, they tried to kidnap Brandy in the last issue.
Yeah,
so it looks really, really cool, really, really good page by Sal there. Love it.
That's right. And we again see that Brandy's got feelings for Rom, but you know, Steve's holding fast to her. He doesn't even consider that she might have romantic intentions towards Rom, because after all, in his mind he's a robot. But Brandy suspects different. She thinks she knows he used to be a man. And then Rom also obviously has feelings for Brandy, as we've established in past episodes, right, Billy? So he looks at Brandy, and then in his mind's eye, he sees his lost love, 200 years gone in the past, Reyna from Galador, and when he was still a man. Yeah. And then he remembers their last night together, I think it was. Now, they don't show the naughty bits, but they do definitely show the sad parts where they say farewell to each other. And Reyna begs him not to do it, but he's been chosen of the hundreds of thousands of Galadorians who applied. Only 1,000 were deemed fit to survive the process, right, to become space knights.
Yeah.
So he was selected, so he cannot turn it down now because, their lives and the universe hangs in the balance. And then he remembers. And now, Billy, this is a great scene. On page 3, you've got this farewell scene in Rom's memory between him and Reyna. And then he says, "No, my darling." Because she asks, "And what of us, Rom? Is this the end of our love?" And he says, "No, even if this war lasts for thousands of years and spans the endless void of space, I promise you our love will never die." And then he looks at Steve hugging Brandy, and he's just thinking that final word to emphasize his thoughts. Never.
They do good writing. They do that at the beginning of this sequence, and now at the end, like you said, where it's, you know, Rom is kind of showing that he has feelings for Brandy, and that it's kind of making him think of his love Raina there. So yeah, good job there. I really like the, you know, the writing and the artwork, especially it's are real good on those pages.
Amazing, man. And then we cut to page 6 where Archie Stryker's now being turned over by the cops who were first on the scene here, and they also investigate the car that Rom, well, basically tossed aside and then vanished the race to limbo. But there are these ashen forms on the ground, you know, the the type of detritus or material that the wraiths excrete once they're banished to limbo, right? The excess matter. And then they manage, the cops manage to flip Archie Stryker around, even though he must weigh like a ton or something. And Archie looks terrible, man. What Rom did to him there, and what he did to himself, whew, that took a serious toll on him. But he's still alive, so the government shows up, and of course, these are the wraiths. You know, you have Rachel Sweet, you have Agent Crawler, and then they just, you know, flash their badges and say, this is S.H.I.E.L.D., this is the you know, and the federal government, you know, because they've got raids in every, you know, form of government, right? In every government institution. So they recover Archie's body, but they put these anti-gravity discs on him and then levitate him into the vehicle that they brought. And the cops are flabbergasted. I thought they were going to kill the cops at one point in time for witnessing this type of science. But the cops, they just say, okay, this is S.H.I.E.L.D. Because think about it, Billy, in the Marvel Universe, S.H.I.E.L.D.'s got some crazy-ass science fiction devices. So I don't think the cops in the Marvel Universe will you know, think twice when seeing this super science employed by the government. And then Rachel Sweet investigates the what seems to be the dead forms of the wraiths. And then, you know, they're going to hunt Rom. So they bring out these creatures that we haven't heretofore seen. And this shows that the wraiths, they're scientifically advanced. Not just, you know, they don't just have magical powers. They can sort of create these demon-type canines called hellhounds.
Yeah.
Now, Billy, speak about these. I mean, they can smell a space knight, apparently.
Yeah, it's creepy, man. They're real scary looking, too. I mean, they look like regular dogs, sort of, but they look like they want to just, you know, rip you to pieces. And like the one cop says, dogs, what kind of bloodhounds are those? Without eyes, because their eyes are just completely white.
Yeah, they're sightless. Yeah. So what I'm thinking is these are, you know, dogs from Earth that they sort of genetically, you know, mutated experimented on, or even magically combining their mysticism with their science and then created these hellhounds. And Rom then sees, okay, this is going to go badly for Brandy and Steve. They're in the line of fire. So he grabs them and he activates his rocket pack, their rocket pods, and they're off. And the dogs go absolutely mental. And then, now this is another part where, you know, the cops should have, I mean, they're cops, right? So they're trained to do some critical thinking here. Because every single person from the federal government that just showed up, even from S.H.I.E.L.D., they pull out the exact same science fiction-esque blasters and start, read. They start blasting, trying to blast Rom out of the air. And the cops just dismiss it as, oh, this is just some more S.H.I.E.L.D. adventures, right? Got nothing to do with us. One of them tried to protest early on, but to no avail.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ever wish you could sip cocktails and discuss great books with your friends while hanging out in a rundown piano bar? Here on the Literary Guys podcast, that's what we do. I'm Dr. Gordon McCallan.
And I'm author Zachary Kellyan. Each month, we discuss books from two different views of modern masculinity.
From both a gay
and a straight perspective.
From To Kill a Mockingbird
to future governors in the jungle trying to kill a predator. We welcome everyone to join our conversation on the good and toxic of what literature and pop culture have to say about masculinity. So pour yourself a drink and join us now for Season 3.
Literary Guys. That's G-U-I-S-E. LiteraryGuys.com.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, the one cop's like, hey, you know, that robot's carrying two people. Like, you know, stop shooting at him. And they're just like, you know, mind your own business, pal. This is, you know, a government operation, of course, you know. And that's kind of how it would work, to be honest with you, because, you know, if it's just some local cop, if the federal government would be there, they would just take over. So exactly. It's pretty accurate. Pretty accurate, actually.
I think you're probably right there, man. You're probably right. I mean, the small town cops, they even recognize Brandy and Steve, you know, because everybody knows everybody in the small town of Clareton. But now, these federal guys don't seem to care about blasting them out of the sky.
And poor Archie.
Poor Archie, man. He's awake. Whoa. He's conscious as he listens to Agent Crawler and Rapes. Rachel Sweet discussing his fate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he realizes Rom was right, and he lies there in pain and bleeding in his armor, thinking, Rom was right. I've been used, tricked by beings from outer space, turned into a metal monster by the Dire Wraiths. So now he even calls them by their right name. which he definitely heard from Rom, because...
Mm-hmm.
The Dire Wraiths had never named themselves that in his presence. So Rom was when he was trying to reason with Archie.
Mm-hmm.
So then, Rom speeding across the countryside with Steve and Brandy. There's no way that the Wraiths can catch up to him. So they've abandoned pursuing Rom for now. But they're going to keep looking. And then this is the scene where we see Brandy still, she's hung up on Rom here. And Steve, he doesn't notice because he's so enraptured with the fact that they're flying, right?
Yeah.
But, Brandy sort of touches Rom's face while they're flying, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she says, I wonder what the man who accepted imprisonment within this lifeless armor was like. And then we see Rom's human face superimposed over his new metal one. And
I love that.
Oh, that's a great... Oof, Salbushema, man. You know, it's not just about how great he pencils. It's also about how he times these little moments, and also about his sort of panel designs and the angles. It all works, right? But then
it's incredible.
They're still flying, looking for a place to shelter, because after all, this is in the middle of the night. They've been going for 24 hours without rest or any sustenance. So they've I think it was Brandy who spots this abandoned cottage, or maybe a little bit bigger than a cottage. Yeah, let's call it a house. And when they see it, Rom says his scanning sensor eyes have already seen the house. so we know there's trouble coming. I mean, we already saw that on the cover, right, Billy? So they enter, but before they could open the door, the door opens by itself. Creak. So we know there's some strange happenings already.
Shenanigans afoot here. Yep.
And they're so tired.
Yeah,
Speak on this, but
yeah, they all take a nap here. Yeah, they all take a nap here. I love it. They're all like, "Oh, what are we gonna do?" And like, "Oh, we don't want to start a fire in the fireplace because then that would alert people from further away, especially the Wraiths that somebody's in this house and they might get suspicious." So Steve just lights a candle or an oil lamp. And they all kind of just think, let's get a nap. And then what I found crazy was, Vrom, who's, basically almost like a robot, and he sits down and he kind of like powers down here.
Hmm.
And his eyes start to fade. And then, his little visor there where his eyes stick out, his red, glowing red eyes go dark.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden you see this smoke fill the room, like something's burning.
Yeah.
Yeah, these vapors, and all of a sudden Rom says, dreaming, he's dreaming, and then you see none other than Doctor Strange come through the front door.
Yeah, and that's where we see how Doctor Strange banished the creature who is the very body of the house. This house is not a real, structure, it's his body. And, he's named the Dweller in the Darkness, right, Billy? He's also got
the Dweller in the Shadows.
The Dweller in the Shadows. He's also got some ties to, the whole Lovecraftian Marvel universe, like Shuma Gorath, and all of them. So, very interesting character. I love the fact that when Salbushema draws him later on, you see his eyes sort of, it's like the house's walls has become flesh. And we already see that now, because not only is Rom entwined by these vapors that become these bands that sort of lock his legs together, but you also see these hands extending from behind Brandy and Steve out of the wall, very organic-looking hands, and then ready to grab them. And I like stories like that, where the house is not so much haunted as the house itself is evil. You know what mm-hmm. I mean, Billy?
Yeah,
there's a great Richard Matheson tale, a novel, in fact, called Hell House. And there's also mm-hmm. there was also a movie about that, although I never saw that movie, which mm-hmm. which deals with this concept. So, you know, that's basically what the story is here. Rom has to fight mm-hmm. an old Doctor Strange villain that Doctor Strange defeated when he was still not yet the Sorcerer Supreme.
Right.
But this is going to be tough going for Rom, because after all, this is magical mysticism. This is, you know, sorceress, and Rom's science-based. So we know that doesn't always go well for, you know, science fiction characters versus these fantasy sorcerers or these
demons.
Yeah,
I mean, his neutralizer seems to hurt it, though, so that's pretty cool. He blasts it right in its head or face. You would think it's where he's blasting.
It screams. Yeah, I love that. The house mm-hmm. itself mm-hmm. It screams. And, you know, so we've got two kind of horror tropes introduced here, right, Billy? Hellhounds, mm-hmm. which is a thing. It's definitely a trope, you know, like I'm not just talking about Cujo here from Stephen King. Even before that, you had movies like Dracula's Dog. Or you had, yep. you know, in some movies, these hounds from hell. And these, mm-hmm. of course, these dire wraith hounds are specifically called the Hellhounds of the Dark Nebula. yeah, and then, of course,
good
now,
name.
Yeah, very good name. Oof. And then you've got the Dweller in the Shadows. So, mm-hmm. you know, two great, you know, horror-esque kind of creatures here introduced.
Yeah.
And this is also actually, you know, not just the first appearance of the Hellhounds, but also, now that I think about it, of Reyna. We haven't seen Reyna before.
No.
You know, Rom's, you know, girlfriend from Galador.
Love, yeah.
It's his lost love, yeah. So very Shalabal-esque. You know, like
yeah.
Silver Surfer-based. But Billy, now Rom takes this monster out in spectacular fashion. Let's speak about this battle.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to, you know, like I said, be hurt by his neutralizer, but it has the drop on him because, you know, it's basically the house and this creature are one. So he turns his back and it launches a table at him and knocks him down and then holds him down for a little bit and starts to grab Brandy and Steve. But then he gets really pissed off and smashes the table because he sees them being carried off. And then the creature kind of reveals itself to him. With his analyzer, which is kind of funny, again, because his, you know, analyzer you wouldn't think would work on something like that, but it does, and he, you know, reveals it.
Yeah.
Then we see the whole Doctor Strange bit again there. We see a panel where it's, you know, Doctor Strange was
where he banishes him. Yeah, from In Strange Tales mm-hmm. 120. And we also see Rom employing the translator, because at first he doesn't understand how the creature's trying to communicate with him. So it seems that the translator... It's really a universal or an omniversal translator, because it can translate anything, mm-hmm. right? Thoughts, mm-hmm. You know, vocal language.
Speech, yeah.
Speech, you know. And then, of course, like you say, the energy analyzer can analyze literally anything. So mm-hmm. you must kind of expect that of the Galadorian scientists who ever created the energy analyzer, because after all, they were... specifically creating the space sites to deal with the dire wraiths who have magical capabilities, right, Billy? So they probably put some form of science in there that could sense magical energy or detect it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we see these flashback panels, like you say, as the creatures start talking to Rom, the Dweller in the Shadows. And then, you know, they have a little bit of a back and forth between them. And mm-hmm. then, you know, Rom speaks reverently about Doctor Strange, whom he saw in his dream.
Yeah.
And then he says, I have seen the visions of the power of this Doctor Strange. And then right after that, the creature gets upset, you know, at the mention of Doctor Strange. So, vroosh, out of the fireplace comes this blast of demonic fire, just bathing Rom. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I didn't even hear a yell from him. Like, when fire falls living flame, you know, enveloped Rom, he was in agony. Mm-hmm. But here... Yeah. This demon fire, which should be able to possibly hurt Rom, because after all, this is not... I mean, Rom can fly past suns, you know, in space, so he's like the Silver Surfer, you know, heat doesn't really bother him. But I thought this magical flame would do something. No, Rom just completely ignores the flame, and he just, you know, he says, okay, I don't have sorcerous means to banish you, but I have my neutralizer, and it's a weapon which can shatter... So he shattering the body of the house, the brick, you know, the creature's face. and even creates like an energy effect that fights fire with fire in his own words. Vree! I love that sound effect of the
yeah, it's good.
In the neutralizer. And then no, after the creature realizes that it too can burn, Rom, you know, exits by freeing Brandy and Steve. And then it's my favorite bit. This creature's burning to death and the house turns into its face, right, Billy? This red face with just these two eyes begging Rom for mercy.
Yeah.
Monstrous. And Billy, then what does Rom do when the creature says, you spare me, we can rule the world together?
He just says, be gone, creature of the soulless night, and whips out the neutralizer and zaps the crap out of him and says, vanish as the rays of my neutralizer banish you to whatever realm of shadows spawned your kind. And you see him getting,
you just see the
destroyed. Yeah.
Yeah. The face. It's almost like, you know, some Native Americans scalped this guy, but didn't scalp, you know, the top of his head, but rather scalped his face. And then, you know, this mask, like, this living mask is banished to limbo here. I love it. It's great. And the same as the Wraiths, they all shout, no, as they're hurled into limbo. That seems to be the standard phrase you need to pass through these barriers, you know, into limbo. The house is gone. And then, now this is this final panel is fantastic, because this is also the Brandy and Steve's first encounter with the supernatural. I mean, other than the dire wraiths, which they know existed, they were not aware of the rest of the Marvel Universe's plagues. You know, they were not aware of stuff like Mephisto or Dormammu.
Doctor Strange even, you know, I mean, they don't seem to have known about.
No, they didn't even know about the Doc. And, you know, then they say, so Rom, There are other dangers on Earth that we have to worry about other than the dire wraiths? And then Rom says, yes, Brandy, many malevolent forces threaten mankind. And what does Steve say there at the end?
Great, like we need it anymore.
Yeah, you're going to get a lot more, Steve. Rom's firmly in the Marvel Universe now. He's not just going to deal with dire wraiths. He's going to have the whole of supervillainy, you know, that's at one point in time going to show up, right?
And then, you know, something topical. Next issue.
Dog Day Afternoon. Al Pacino. What?
Yep.
But they didn't even...
Rom screaming, Attica, Attica.
Yeah, there you go, man. Jeez. I mean, obviously, Mantlo must have just fresh off of the success of watching, you know, of the movie Dog Day Afternoon. But, you know,
That's great.
Okay, obviously, the Hounds of the Black Nebula, you know, Hellhounds and Stay, you know, that's a very appropriate title. But, you know, I'm surprised that they directly lifted the title from the movie. You know, normally Marvel would sort of take the title and tweak it a little bit, you know. Hog Day Afternoon or something. I don't know. But, you know, here they just directly lifted it. Yeah. Yeah. No shame. Mm-hmm. So then, Billy, we got the debut of Space Notes, which is the mailbag section at the end. And we've got our first mail trickling in here. All praise, though. Everybody's just got a lot of praise for Bull Mantlo. We've even got a little bit of Bull Mantlo's origin, his history, his credentials here at the at the very end. And yeah, people are just loving Rom. They're writing in here with praise, and Mantlo replies to them, you know, while he replied to two guys, and, you know, some pretty good comments there. So Rom was obviously making a big splash. Yeah. Lots of folks loved it. Yeah, so that's Space Notes. And in fact, in all of the issues that we're going to be discussing on today's episode, there will be letter columns that appear. You know, we've got one showing up in Godzilla, and then we've got one in the Micronauts. You know, so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Billy, again, yeah, absolutely, this is a 5 out of 5 issue for me. But, you know, I'm saying that, you know, in terms of what I enjoyed reading more, there might be another comic that shows up on this radar just because of the sheer wackiness of said issue. But we'll get to that when we get there. But this is definitely firing on all rocket pods or firing on all cylinders, this ROM issue.
Mm-hmm. It's great.
So let's head off into our next issue, Godzilla. Billy, do you have some details about Godzilla number 5, King of the Monsters?
Yeah, Godzilla number 5, 1977, December 1977, and the Isle of Lost Monsters. And cover, I think, is by Herb Trimpe, but the credits that I had a question mark, as if they weren't 100% sure on that one.
Yeah, no, it is by Herb Trimpe and Klaus Janson. At least that's what my research revealed. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and then Doug Mensch, writer; Tom Sutton, artist; Klaus Janson, inker; John Costanza, letterer; Phil Rachelson, colorist; and Archie Goodwin, editor. What a lineup there!
Oof. That is a great lineup, man. And now this is already the second issue in a row that Tom Sutton, one of our favorite ever horror artists, has penciled. Of course, next, Herb Trimpe will return again. But wow, I love Sutton here. He's really found his footing just after one issue. I mean, the previous issue was good too, but this one is the best. Mm-hmm. He's really stretching his artistic skills here, because he's got to draw lots of different kind of monsters, and he's also got to draw the battle that's going on, G.I. Joe-esque type of battle between S.H.I.E.L.D. and Dr. Demonicus's demon soldiers. The Eskimos are in there, Dum Dum and Gabriel, they're all distinct. So yeah, Tom Sutton brings it, I'm telling you. He's like pulling a George Perez here or something.
Oh, absolutely.
So Billy, this time it's my turn to go with the synopsis first, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Twitter style, here we go. As Godzilla fends off the S.H.I.E.L.D. mosquitoes, Dum Dum and Gabriel uncover the sinister secret of Dr. Demonicus. Godzilla tears through the mutated kaiju, while Dum Dum battles the mother of all Mothras. After drawing out Demonicus's origin story, Gabriel Jones single-handedly takes out the goon squad, then delivers some sweet chin music to Dr. Demonicus, and Godzilla saves Dum Dum. So all's well that ends well. Or is it? Yeah, so that's my small summary there. So Billy, what about you? What do you have for us?
Okay, so as Godzilla rampages, Dum Dum and Gabe join the rest of the team in trying to stop the enormous beast. Meanwhile, Dr. Demonicus releases his other three bestial creations, and the ensuing battle may destroy everyone.
classic, love it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We should really release these on Twitter, just to tease something for non-patrons. But yeah, this is pretty good. Some great copy there that you're writing for us. So, Billy, man, what do you think about this cover?
Okay, so, again, I have very few single issues of Godzilla, like maybe two. So I'm looking at it in the essentials. So I'm not seeing the color, so you'll have to speak on the color. But I like it, and part of it is just, Godzilla, the comic, is always going to appeal to me, especially when it has monsters fighting, Godzilla, because I love the Showa era of Godzilla, where it was a lot of the monster-on-monster action, So same. I think it's pretty good.
Mm. I mean, they tease it on the cover, the greatest monster battle yet, and they're spot on. This is the greatest one we've seen so far in the comic. I mean, the previous one against Batragon, who was also one of the spawn of this Life Jewel and Dr. Demonicus's pets, one of his pets. So that was a pretty spectacular fight. But this one, it ups the ante by quite a lot. So yeah, I believe the colors are different from, the interiors. You've got these three. You've got one Mothra-like creature. You've got one Gila monster-like creature. And then you've got this, insectoid, wormish, caterpillar-like creature. And they're all different than the colors from, like, for instance, the Gila monster's brown. In the interiors, he's the purple blackish. And, Mothra is brown, a different shade of brown than the Gila monster. But, in the interiors, she's purple, or he, or whatever. And then the monster slug thing, or worm, whatever you would call it, it's yellow in the interiors, but it's purple on the cover. But it's still it's a great image.
Yeah, we know that happens from time to time, because the cover artist, especially when the cover artist and the interior artist are not the same person, that does happen from time to time. But on this black and white, copy I have here, the essential, where that Gila monster is biting down on Godzilla, it almost looks like one of Dr. Demonicus's little men has their face inside the guy's jaws by Godzilla's shoulder there. Do you see that? There's almost like this little skull-type face in his teeth there.
Oh, I got it. I spotted it now. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, is there a little guy in there?
Yeah, it does look like one of his...
I think it was just an accident, but it's funny.
Yeah, yeah, that's the way it looks. It's really like, okay, we see patterns, right, easily in clouds and stuff, and now we see this pattern in this in this jaw, well, between the jaws of this creature. Yeah, it does look like his the face mask worn by the demon soldiers, definitely. Mm-hmm. Holy crap. And you know, it looks like, it doesn't look like they're fighting on the life jewel at all. It looks like they're fighting on the moon.
The moon!
Yeah. So, like craters.
Craziness.
Oh man, love it.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's awesome. It's, I love it. It's funny, but it just totally makes no sense.
Yeah. Isle of the Living Demons. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, aren't all demons alive? I mean, they're not ghosts. They had to put living in there. I mean, you can understand the living dead, the nice contrast created by those two words, right? But Isle of the Living Demons, there's no need to put demons in there, right?
Well, no, the interior, the first splash page there, that's a much better title. The Isle of Lost Monsters.
That's what they should have gone with. Yeah, the Isle of Lost Monsters, because that's more accurate. And we've got S.H.I.E.L.D. just going crazy, blasting Godzilla, because he's standing on the lip of this volcano, which is actually an inactive volcano containing this life jewel. And Dum Dum and Gabe are in one of these mosquito, they call it the dragonfly. Dragonflies. These mosquito type helicopters, and they're blasting away at Godzilla, and now they're really pouring it on, right? Because they want to take him out now. But Dr. Demonicus, he's still, you know, sticking with his plan, which was revealed last issue. He's going to let them wear each other out, S.H.I.E.L.D. versus Godzilla, and then he's going to attack whoever's the victor, who would be weakened. And then that's his plan. But then, you know, while dodging Godzilla, Gabe and Dum Dum, they have to, you know, enter the volcano briefly just to get away from Godzilla's flailing and from his nuclear breath. They see the energy grid that sort of contains these kaiju that Dr. Demonicus have created.
Mm-hmm.
And Billy then...
The Mothra type creature is really attracted to these dragonflies because they look similar and just is attacking them and trying to bite them, and that's how Gabe and Dum Dum get in trouble.
Yeah, it's like the moth saw competition or saw a similar mate. Oh, they're lucky the moth didn't try to mate with them or something with that helicopter. Oh, damn.
Gross.
Because, that would be gross. But this little Gila monster is pretty cute. It's got multiple limbs, right, Billy? I count like 8 limbs, and it's climbing up the side of the volcano to engage Godzilla in the fight once Dr. Demonicus shut down the energy grid. Because after all, now that Dr. Demonicus's kaiju are seen as being housed inside this volcano, S.H.I.E.L.D., who previously thought, Dum Dum thought this was just an American military base being attacked by Godzilla, now he realizes, no, this is something more sinister. This got nothing to do with the states. This is a supervillain lair.
Not just any supervillain, a crazy supervillain that's a bigot. So why don't you speak on that?
he keeps calling Gabriel a black man. Hey, black man. This is crazy. Yeah, but guess what happens once I forgot to mention, right, Billy, is once the Mothra-type ripoff creature grabs a hold of Gabriel and Dum Dum's dragonfly. Gabriel, he falls out, you know, of the, or he leaps out to see what's happening, you know, below, you know, kind of like, he's not exactly using a parachute. He's sort of like abseiling down from the dragonfly, and then the dragonfly gets attacked. So he has to, his cords are severed, and he plunges the rest of the way and through this dome, where the life jewel is held, and into Dr. Demonicus's headquarters. And that's where we see Dr. Demonicus being this reprehensible, bigoted scumbag.
Racist. Looks right at him. Looks right at him, points a gun at him. Freeze, black man. And Gabe's like, what? You should talk, weirdo.
But then Gabriel also throws the racism back at him. He says, he doesn't pretend to be racist. I mean, he obviously knows where it's going to go. So he says, I hope you don't mind me dropping in like this. I hope it doesn't spoil the neighborhood. You know, which is sort of what white folks, racist white folks sometimes say, right? So
it's a good one, though. It's a good comeback. Gabe, that's an awesome scene there. But like you said, he doesn't stop with it. Like every time he starts to like kind of address Gabe throughout the rest of the issue, he says that. He doesn't say, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. agent, human, anything like that. Listen, black man. Hey, black man. He keeps saying that to him.
Oh, man. It's terrible.
Yeah.
Dude,
he's
and now,
crazy.
Yeah, no, it's bad. But Gabe's gonna get his own back here. He's gonna get some revenge on Dr. Demonicus. But Dr. Demonicus sort of, for a scientist, probably an older guy too, he sort of conducts himself well in a fight. I mean, Gabe's a highly trained S.H.I.E.L.D. agent, right? So, but this guy gives him a run for his money. But first, you know, before that happens, this is where we see that S.H.I.E.L.D. originally was probably the original G.I. Joe. Because the S.H.I.E.L.D. agents land in the Dragonflies and they start fighting these Cobra-esque villains, the demon soldiers of Dr. Demonicus, in this all-out, you know, melee in the snow, right, Billy? This firefight. And then the Eskimos get in on it. You know, they...
Yeah, well... No. It showed them last issue getting pissed off at Dr. Demonicus because he basically subjugated them and is like making them work sometimes to the point of death. You know what I mean? So he's like let's put it in real terms. He's a really good villain because he's an awful human being and you want this guy to just get clobbered. And then, like you said, Gabe is pretty smart. So he tries to say to him, like, you know, hey, what about your background? Like, what's this all about trying to stall him? So, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. can get into a better position here, and then wow, we see Godzilla just completely obliterate that one, you know, worm-like creature or snail-like
with
creature,
whatever
the hell that thing
breath was.
Yeah, it says, and vanquishing one of them forever, and he kills it.
Wow, and he smacks the Gila monster with his tail while simultaneously frying this worm beast. So yeah, you're right, Billy. So then he keeps frying this beast until, you know, it's completely melted into this puddle of sludge. It's just great. And then Dr. Demonicus, man, what an idiot. He falls for this, you know, Gabe trying to stall for time, this monologue. Gabe even thinks about it. He says, this is so typical of this villain. You know, he's just monologuing. Mm-hmm. He starts to monologue.
Looks like my stalling tactics are going to work.
Yeah,
Dr. Demonicus. You know how it is, especially Silver Bronze Age. Evil villain types love to talk about themselves and, you know, say how awesome they are and reveal way too much more than they should.
That's right, man. This worked against old Dr. Demonicus because what happens is, okay, now he's got an interesting origin. You know, he used to be a geneticist that, you know, studied the effects of radiation and mutation
in
living cells. Yeah. And then he was exposed to a deadly dose of radiation and that drove him insane. But when they fired him because of that, he wouldn't accept it. You know, he said his genius was being ignored. So he then witnessed the meteor crashing to Earth, which was this life stone. And then he immediately, you know, decided to hunt down this meteor. And he finally found it and then used its unique radiation to create these kaiju monsters. But then we cut to Godzilla still battling with the Gila monster and then Dum Dum in dire straits here. He's in big trouble. This monster creature is like got him, you know, upside down, you know, flying around with him, smashing him into the... And Dum Dum, the only recourse he has to battling this monster is to lean out of the window upside down and shoot at Mothra, this Mothra thing, with his sidearm. And he says, Lego, you blasted overgrown wool eater.
I said Lego, and I'm going to make you let go. If I have to stuff this blamed zap gun with mothballs and jam it right down your slimy throat.
There's the moth connection, yeah.
Oh, so good, yeah.
Yeah, but then the narration caption says, but even at point blank range, no dice.
It's not working. You see, this is, a big giant radioactive creature. What's like a handgun going to do against it? It's not going to do nothing.
Exactly. Now here you realize that Dr. Demonicus, he really loves his creations because after all, he took the trouble of naming them, right? So, you know, Gilaron, Lepirax, Centipore, right? Earlier, he even shouted at them, defend your creator when he released the energy grid, right, Billy? So what happens when Godzilla, when during his monologue with Gabe, Dr. Demonicus managed to glance at the screen and he sees the death of, you know, the centipede-like kaiju. And he says, Centipore! He's not out there! Where is he?
and then what does Gabe say? He's probably hanging out somewhere, Demonicus. Got enough arms for the job. And tell me more about your fascinating story. And then here we go again. You think I won't, black man? It's like, holy crap, this guy is really out of control.
Yeah.
Well, Doug Mensch is really, he wants people to really not like this guy, and he's doing a good job.
Oh, yeah, it's working. I mean, we already didn't like him just because of his, you know, war crimes here. Well, crimes against humanity when he was slaughtering those Eskimos. But here, it's like turning it up to another notch on the racism meter.
He goes into, and then he goes into his whole background of once he got to the Aleutians and, you know, the whole volcano and where that meteorite fell and how he subjugated these the Inuit people there, and he's looking a really crazy picture of him. Like he's got a bat in one hand and a Komodo dragon in the other, which it must be just a youth because they're pretty freaking big. And he just has it in the palm of his hand. And he says about subjecting the tissues of various life forms, such as bat and a Komodo dragon, to the meteor's cosmic radiation. That's a crazy panel.
And then it's like,
choking the bat.
Yeah, dude.
It's like screaming.
No, that poor bat, and that's the genesis of his favorite creature that perished last issue, Batragon.
Yeah,
because it's a bat and a Komodo dragon, and that creates a real dragon. That's according to Marvel science. And then he created this flying this is now in his mind. He's going to use he took the metal that he found in the meteor and created his base. Because this metal has all kinds of amazing properties. Now he's projecting an image of the future here with his words. He says he's going to take over the world with this magnificent life jewel and his creatures that he's created, but also with the science that he has. And then we see this picture of a Kraken-like creature straight out of Clash of the Titans, you know, wrapping its arms around a cruise ship there and plaguing the city with tidal waves and him flying above with Batragon wearing a kind of mask or some kind of eagle monster. It could be a cassowary. I don't know what is that thing. And another type of moth creature there on this flying platform just ruling, just conquering the Earth.
Yeah, and I mean, take note, Clash of the Titans didn't come out for 3 more years, so that's kind of wild. And then, you know, Dr. Demonicus and his gang of soldiers here very much remind you of Cobra Commander and, you know, Cobra Organization, which, again, that's a few years from coming out yet as well.
Yeah, this could have been an inspiration for that, Billy. You never know.
Could have.
Yeah, it could have, definitely. And then, you know, there's this fantastic scene where he says, you know, this is his dream. And then Gabriel says, well, if you look at the screen, weirdo, there's someone out there who doesn't exactly share your screwball dream. His name's Godzilla. And then Godzilla, you know, when Dr. Demonicus glances at the screen, Godzilla's busy wringing the neck of this Gila monster, Gilaron. And what does Demonicus say?
He goes, no, Gilaron, he's hurting Gilaron. And Gabe again says, face it, weirdo, he ain't hurting him. He's turning him into mincemeat.
Gabe's like driving the nail home here. And then, you know, Gilaron, my creation, he's dying. Godzilla slaying Gilaron. He just keeps repeating it, you know, like a broken record. And then he turns his back and he says he has to aid his creatures. They have to take the battle to Godzilla himself. And then Gabe sees his opening. Now, here we see some SHIELD training coming into play, right? He takes out, by my count, Billy, takes out 4 of Dr. Demonicus's goons in, what, a second?
His demons.
His demons, like he calls them, these demon Cobra soldiers. And then Dr. Monicus whips out this huge, sci-fi Magnum 44. We don't know what this thing is, but it's a massive.
Well, look at it. It really kind of reminds you of the same gun the Race had back in that Ron issue. It kind of does.
Exactly, dude.
Those laser pistols they have. But yeah, Demonicus, again, by the way, this maniac. As if it's not bad enough what he says to Gabe all the time. Then he says about, we seize the island and enslave the stupid Eskimos. Yeah, I'm like, whoa, this guy's really a nut.
Yeah, man, exactly. Yeah, he's really crazy. And then, you know, he gets tackled by Gabe. Gabe just calls it, you know, he's ready for a tussle. But, Gabe's looking forward to giving him the beating of his life. And then, you know, Billy, just this is not in the essentials, but right between page 17 and page 22, which is the next page, there's some Marvel ads. I just want to highlight the one page. It's the debut of the Godzilla letter columns, and it's got called Godzilla Grams. Oh. Yeah. And we've got, you know, Doug Munch only replies to one of the you know, letter writers here, but there's, by my count, at least 8 letters printed. And all of them have praise as well for this issue. So they might have selected these letters, obviously, just because of the positive things said by the readers, right? So they
I know it did well, especially with, you know, younger readers. It did sell really well.
Yeah. There's only one thing that's a little bit weird here. An Asian-American guy writes in. He's called Bill Wu, right? Bill Wu writes in, and he says, you know, essentially he says he admires the way they portray Asian people in this, this comic. I'm like, what?
they barely do to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, he's talking about the task force that you know, was drafted from that Tony got from Japan. But still, I don't think I agree with him there. You know, but maybe this is the best representation they got.
Well, you know what? Point. I'm thinking, yep, you're absolutely right there. I think he'd probably looked at a comic, you know, 5 years earlier and saw, you know, some really, you know, horrible stuff. I mean, hey, maybe this guy was in his 50s and he remembers stuff from like World War II era. So compared to that, this is like, you know, this would be great for, you know, an Asian person to see compared to that.
Exactly, man. And then you've got this one letter writer. This is just interesting. I just want to mention this, Billy. He writes in saying that Godzilla is a breath of fresh air, a breath of fresh radioactive air, because, you know, essentially there are too many superheroes flooding the market. He's sick of superhero comics. He wants something like Godzilla.
Wow.
Yeah, I can't believe it. That's harsh. So obviously not a lot of indie comics around at the time that would deal with, you know, stuff other than superheroes. There were some underground indies, but they were hard to come by. So this guy was you know, tired of that. Yeah, so he got Godzilla. But, you know, I think there were many other comics out there without superheroes. If you count the horror titles from DC, you know, from Marvel.
Oh, yeah. Think about it.
I think
Conan.
Conan is not superhero. You know,
Tarzan. All the stuff that we're doing, like Shang-Chi really isn't a superhero comic. Like you said, that's more like, you know, a spy thriller, martial arts type thing. There was, there was stuff out there to be had. Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, so interesting letter there. And then, Billy, the ad on that Godzilla gram page is for Doctor Strange, for Doctor Strange's comic. It's Journey into the World of the Weird, the Occult, the Magical with Doctor Strange, Master of the Mystic Arts. It's a great ad.
One that says, do you know what else does it say there? Is there any other copy there? Because there is that one really cool Doctor Strange ad that you see in comics around 1980, somewhere in there, where they promised a Frank Miller Doctor Strange never happened.
I remember that one. No, this is not.
I love that.
This is not that one. Yeah, but that one, that's a classic. We'll find that and post that on Twitter. Why not? Right, to see so that the patrons can see what we're talking about. Yeah. And then, Billy, we cut back to the issue. Now, this is where Dr. Demonicus, you know, he shows his fighting skills, his chops here in combat, hand-to-hand combat, because he smacks Gabriel.
And more of his bigotry.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Tussle, black man. It's like, what? You can't just be like, I'll kick your rear end or something. Why does he have to keep saying that?
Yeah, and I mean, it's almost as if he's an Aryan. He sees himself as of the race of Aryans, but he doesn't look like that. He looks decidedly Asian to me in his, you know, flashbacks, but not really. But, you know, he doesn't look like an Aryan superhuman.
Yeah, the flashbacks to me, he looked like, it's like some old decrepit dude. He almost looks a little like Mordo in that one.
Yeah, with the hair.
One panel. Yeah,
he does. A young Mordo, the beard and the goatee. Yeah, definitely. And then, you know, you've got Dum Dum being pulled out of this, the body of the dragonfly by his legs, by, you know, the Mothra creature. And then, you know, he's in serious trouble here, really. I mean, Dum Dum needs a rescue double quick. And then who comes to his rescue, Billy?
None other than Godzilla.
That's right.
Inexplicably.
I mean, Godzilla should hate him at this point in time. But, you know, he takes a final blast at Mothra, you know, with typical Dum Dum Dugan, you know, dialogue along the way. I'm warning ya. I'm a tough old bird. You know, you're thinking... What does he say?
What's the matter? What's the matter? You don't believe I'm so tough? Well, chew on this for a while. He shoots it right in the mouth.
And this Mothra knockoff Leparax smashes him into the mountain. And Dum Dum's, oh no, not this again. And then the S.H.I.E.L.D. guys are getting the better of the demon soldiers. They have this bazooka. They call it an incendiary bazooka. And along with the Eskimos, they charge this base of Dr. Demonicus. And then they blast it apart with one, you know, blast from the bazooka. And the survivors surrender. And then Gabriel turns the tables on, you know, Dr. Demonicus by punching him in the face. So Gabriel, I don't know how he recovered from that, because the weapon was trained on him, right? But he must have the reflexes of a cat, because he just pushed himself up off the ground, launched him at Dr. Demonicus, and just laid, you know, sucked him on the chin, laid him out.
And then, I gotta be honest with you, sometimes when I read some of these comics in the Bronze Age, I feel a little sad though, because they had some really good characters here that never like got, I don't want to say they never got developed, but they always kind of stayed at like a C level, you know, like African American characters like Gabe and like Bill Foster, you know what I mean? Like they were really good characters. He's a really good character in this comic, you know, and with S.H.I.E.L.D. and stuff like that. They should have developed him more.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I mean, Gabriel Jones is still a stalwart of Marvel, but you're right that he hasn't, we haven't seen a lot of play from, we could have seen more, you know, Dum-Dum even too. Even though he's probably more famous than Gabriel, still you don't see a lot of him either. It's a tragedy, like you say. I've always been a fan, you know, of Gabriel Jones. I don't know why. I just even when he first appeared, he had this classic look. You know, this whole, you know, the golden shield costume. I like that. And he was in World War II. You know. The Howler. You know, similar to Dum-Dum and. And then, of course, they all joined S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was also given the Infinity Formula, right, Billy, during World War II, which caused his longevity, just like Nick Fury.
And, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at his, I think, Wikipedia page or his Marvel fandom, you know, write-up page, there's not a lot there. You know, that's the tragedy of it. You're right. So, but, you know, he showed up in Secret Warriors, which was the Hickman series, I think. You know,
that was really good, man. I actually parted with that last year, and I was kind of sad about it. I think it ran for like 30 issues, and I think I had 20 or 25 out of the 30 issues, and I actually sold them, and I was kind of sad about it. I don't know. I should look and see if they have trades, because that was really, really good.
Yeah, I remember I read them in issues as well, digitally. You know, I was still buying stuff off of Comixology, and it was amazing. But I never have, you know, owned a physical copy of trades or anything. But that was when Hickman was just becoming a well-known writer. He was just making a splash, and wow, I enjoyed that. And I enjoyed the characterization of all these S.H.I.E.L.D. personalities, you know. So that was, I think, if I'm not mistaken, he also died in, I don't know, I can't remember, but I think he died in Secret Wars.
He may have.
Yeah.
He may have.
But they could bring him back, you know. I'm not saying, I've come to accept comic book reality, and they always bring back characters. But if he hasn't been back in the last, what, 11 years, then he might be done for. They might only resurrect him when we're gone, believe us.
Well then, hey, how does Godzilla finally end this battle here? This is a great scene too. It's brutal.
This is amazing, man. This is the best kill that he's done in the entire series. And basically what he does is he rips Leparax off of the dragonfly, sending Dum-Dum to crash luckily into the snow, which probably saved his life.
Then fortunately,
he tosses, even though Leparax can fly, right? Godzilla tosses him into the air and then scorches him with a blast of his atomic breath until he becomes a living fireball. Then, as this living fireball that was Leparax plunges into the snow, Godzilla stamps on him repeatedly until he's this mess of charred flesh. And this is a great kill. It takes three panels, right? Three panels to show that kill. And as he's doing it, Godzilla's got this typical sound effect, rah, coming out.
And then there's Dugan. Sheesh. And Jones thought his landing was a hard one. Huh? And he goes, I don't believe it. The big lizard squashed the thing just like that. Uh-oh. He's lowering his head down this way. And he gets right up to Dugan. And Dugan says, that's it. Just keep your distance. And wait a minute. He's sniffing me and grinning.
Yeah, he's grinning and sniffing Dugan. So what, is this some ironic way of saying, you tried to kill me, but now I saved your life. Take that, asshole. That's what he's saying to Dugan here. But he also might like the guy. And then, you know, hell, maybe he just likes the smell of cigars. Who knows?
cheap ones, probably, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then there's Gabe and our buddy Dr. Demonicus. He's got him on his knees and picks him up by the scruff of his neck, unmasks him, and look at how goofy he looks there. He does look like an old, long-haired, like, drunk Tony Stark in that picture.
Yeah, he does look like a drunk Tony Stark. You're right. Or a hippie or something. Because, yeah, Gabe's, and Gabe's, like, got the smile on his face, too. Yeah, you got what was coming to you, Demonicus. And then the Eskimos thank them for saving their lives. But then it's actually Godzilla. Gabe reminds Dum Dum that, yeah, you have Godzilla to thank for saving your lives and the life of Dum Dum Dugan.
Yeah.
And then Godzilla hits off through, you know, the ocean away from the island with the final raw. And then next issue, Herb Trimpe returns to the art. Dr. Takaguchi's secret is revealed and much more in A Monster Enslaved. But Billy, you and I, we won't be seeing Godzilla anytime soon. We're going to take a bit of a break from the series, if I'm not mistaken, and then we're going to focus on something else. But we'll return to Godzilla pretty soon. Well, maybe not pretty soon. I mean, going by the you know, the time we release the Patreon episodes, it might only be in a year or more. So for now, this is goodbye to our Godzilla coverage, but it's a great issue to end it on. We got a fantastic villain out of the storyline. And we got some amazing kaiju and kaiju battles.
Yeah, really good stuff. Yeah, I'm going to miss it.
Yeah, I'm going to miss it until we return to it again. That's it for Godzilla. But Billy, then we get to another issue, of course, on the slate here. Micronauts number 5. I'll give the details to this one. And now things are really heating up in the Micronauts series. We're seeing it's becoming better and better as you know, Bill Mantlo and Michael Golden go along. They're finding their footing here. So the details on this issue, specifically Micronauts number 5, covered by Michael Golden and inked by Joseph Rubinstein. It was cover dated May 1979, but on sale February the 6th, 1979. And edited by Al Milgram, writer Bill Mantlo, penciler Michael Golden, inked by Joseph Rubinstein. So the same cover team, cover art team. Lettered by James Novak and colored by D.R. Martin. And it was only reprinted once to my, which my research showed, and that was Micronauts Special Edition number 2 from 1984. Other than that, you might have to find the original issue, which is hard to find these days.
Yeah, I don't know how I ended up finding them or where. I don't think it was on eBay. I think maybe it was at a store, but I have like 4, 5, 6, and 7 or 4, 5, 6, and 8 or something like that. And it's, like you said, they're not easy to find, the lower numbers. They are not. Like you can find those reprints. I think they did that with a couple of different titles, but not many, where they would package like 3 or 4 issues in one oversized issue. And that's, like you said, where you can find this one.
That's right. We'll probably never see a collected edition. Well, never say never, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen because of the rights issues.
No, it sucks. Yeah, that's really the only thing that sucks when they do licensed products, if they don't ever have the mind to pay for, you know, a renewal to do it again. It's just, you know, it sucks. Now, we did just get, you know, speaking of, you know, Patreon, we just got Shang-Chi after a long layoff there, but that took a long time.
Yeah, a lot of negotiation on Marvel's part, and it's not forever even, you know, that's not going to last. So, yeah, there will be a time when we won't see any Shang-Chi being reprinted again in its original form.
Yeah, get it. So get it now
while you can. Yeah, definitely. So, Billy, what's your synopsis for this issue of Micronauts?
Okay, the team arrives at the Hell facility to rescue their comrade, Bug. Meanwhile, back at the home of the Coffin family, Biotron is fixing the Endeavor so they may return home. Inside Hell, we see that this Professor Prometheus holds a deadly secret.
Classic. I'm also going with the secret angle in my synopsis here. I said, what is the shocking secret of Hell, the Human Engineering Life Laboratories, and its Prometheus Pit? Ray Coffin and his son Steve are about to find out. Luckily, they've got Bug as their guardian angel. The deranged Philip Prometheus reveals his bionic appendages while the rest of the Micronauts launch a rescue mission. Meanwhile, in the Microverse, Baron Karza has found the perfect body for the aged and evil Belladonna, that of the beautiful rebel Lady Slug. So, yeah, that's what's happening in this comic. Essentially, we've got, again, action in the Microverse featuring Baron Karza and the now, you know, turned into a centaur prince that he's recently, you know, mutated into the centaur, like, or grafted onto a horse body, right? Essentially.
Yeah, it looks really good. Ooh, Prince Argon, yeah.
Ooh, Prince Argon being penciled by Michael Golden in that centaur form is just crazy good. And then you've got, of course, the action still in Daytona Beach and at NASA, where NASA seems to have this facility grafted onto it called HAL.
Yeah, it's funny. It says it right on the side of the building.
H-E-L-L. There you go. Yeah,
HAL. Human Engineering Life Laboratory. It's like, what?
It must
no one would ever do this.
It must be the brainchild of Philip Prometheus, because think about it. He's absolutely nuts. Yeah. He's a nutter. And he's also murderous and psychopathic. And he's also a cyborg, as it turns out, which is a... Well, that comes out as a revelation. Now,
yeah, I mean, I got to be honest. I haven't been real big on Micronauts, the parts of it where they're on Earth, you know, because it's just some of them seem kind of boring to me and kind of silly, you know, with dogs running around and stuff. But the action on Homeworld, you know, has always been really cool to me. I've loved that the best. But this is my favorite issue so far because, you know, this Prometheus Pit and this Dr. Prometheus guy are really creepy. So that really amped up the crazy and creepy here on Earth. Oh, so this is by far my favorite issue.
Yeah, this is the best one so far. For me too, definitely, of the early issues. Other than issue one kind of, you know, had too many, you know, cards on the table. It was playing with too many concepts, tossing them around, being juggled by Mantlo. So it was a setup that had, you know, you kind of have to ease yourself into it. You can't immediately, right off the bat, make a decision about how, if you like it or not. But now you get to the parts of Micronauts that I think cemented the fandom as well. Because it's space opera, but it's also set on Earth, juggling these two, you know, worlds, or these two settings. So you get the best of both worlds eventually. And like you say, Philip Prometheus, also a horror-type villain. Because he's this evil scientist, this mad scientist. He's obsessed with dissecting organic beings from the Microverse. And he's amassed quite the collection so far. That's why he's interested in Ray and Steve Coffin's, you know, dead little Micronauts, dead Acroyers, the dead soldiers that attack them on the lawn, you know, in issue number 2. And that's why, you know, we see that he's definitely a horror type villain, because he makes no qualms about his intentions. He will torture the boy, Steve Coffin, just to get information out of him in full view of his dad, who's being restrained by these robotic, you know, henchmen.
Yeah. Whew. They look like just regular people at first, but when they kind of grab him and start like jostling him around, I don't know if like they have masks on or just like a hat or a hood or something like that. And then you could see they're like almost like robots or something.
That's right. Now let's get to the cover, Billy, first. Like you see on the cover, Philip Prometheus, this half cyborg and Commander Rand blasting at him. And then you see the Prometheus Pit and a Steve Coffin about to tumble down into it with Bug.
This is great.
This is a fantastic cover. And Michael Golden's face, you know, I love the way he draws faces and musculature. It's on full display here. It's amazing.
Well, I'll tell you what. If I ever go to a show again where Michael Golden is there, I'm getting him to sign this one. Yeah. I love this cover. It's great.
It's an amazing cover. Mm. And the opening intro page is great too. It's got two panels, but the topmost panel is sort of introducing the Micronauts rather than, you know, having the Marvel style, you know, text piece that briefly tells the origin of the character, which was famous at this point in time. Here it's that is eschewed in favor of their faces, you know, just showing up, and that's brilliantly penciled by Golden as well. Look at Marionette and Commander Rand; they have real personalities in their faces there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I like that choice. And then we got, you know, them showing up in the Astro Station, their flying Fantastic Four-like vehicle, like the Fantastic Car, showing up there to rescue Bug, because they've been following his insectivorid brainwave patterns, right, Billy?
Mm-hmm.
So this issue is just titled The Prometheus Pit.
Mm-hmm.
And then Croyer shows off his strength again by ripping open the metal fence here. Even though it's electrified, it doesn't even faze him.
Nope.
And even Marionette is impressed by this feat of strength. You know, she looks at it and says, Dallin and Sepsis. Scrang. Invoking Commander Rand's parents there. But before that, Billy, don't you think that this is very much harkening back to the toys of the Micronauts?
Yeah.
You've got the Astro Station with this ejector tube, which could fling its characters into space. And that is the ejector tube that, you know, a Croyer's using to jump towards this electrical fence. Now, the ejector tube does kind of make sense, because normally space gliders are manning this vehicle. So when they want to, like, engage in battle, they would fight on two fronts. Some would fight in the... This is now based on the toys, right? Some would battle in the Astro Station. Some would then be space gliders who have to sort of, like, paratroopers be ejected, right? So that's what this ejector tube is for. But seeing it here in this comic being used, it's kind of comical. You know, it's funny.
Yeah.
Whoosh! He launches. I mean, you remember having toys like that, right, Billy? You would have a toy where one character would be ejected from whatever, you know, almost like a human cannonball.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
And then we cut back to Daytona Beach, home of Ray and Steve Coffin, where, you know, Biotron was left to repair the Endeavor. And he's got his own problems to deal with, because, a hungry cat shows up through the broken window. Looking for some prey. And poor Biotron is going to be the subject of this cat's attentions. But there's another pet, Billy, that the Micronauts see along the way. Now, this is reprehensible on the part of Ray and Steve Coffin. What did they do with their poor little dog?
They left it locked in the car.
What? I mean, that's a death sentence for any animal, for any pet there, right? And it's in Daytona
Beach. I was just going to say, they're in Florida, too. So if this is, like, literally 9 or 10 months out of the year, that dog could be in real trouble, because it stays pretty hot and humid just about all year round in Florida. I mean, you get a couple months of a reprieve there, like December, January, February. But otherwise, it's really hot in Florida.
Yeah, man, that dog could be dead. But the Micronauts save it from a horrible fate by Marie does, right? At first, the rest of the Micronauts says, leave the beast be. It attacked us on the lawn. As we remember in issue 2, and then they ended up blasting the poor dog, right? Looks like, is it a Cocker Spaniel, Billy? It kind of looks like a breed like that, a little bit, or not really?
Could be. Could be.
Maybe.
And it's a cute little dog.
It's very cute, man. And it's recognizing them, but not, you know, it barks at them, but not for, you know, in a violent or an attacking or a way at all. It just wants help or something. And Marie shows off her acrobatic skills by jumping from the Astro Station, somersaulting in the air, and acrobatically landing on the edge of this car door, where she then pries open the window, freeing, you know, the dog. So the dog immediately takes a shine to Princess Marie, and she even allows her to ride her, right? But then the dog can't fit through the window. So what does Commander Rand and Croyer do? He says, Croyer, man the rocket cannon. On my command, fire. What the hell, Commander Rand? They just blast open the window of the pickup truck. Mm-hmm. And then the dog is completely, traumatized by this, and just yipe, yipe, yipe. Just jumps out of the window and runs away with Princess Marie, riding her. And the security guards don't know what to make of it, because the dog runs past them into the Prometheus lab section, and they can't follow because they don't have clearance. So they say, oh, let Professor Prometheus deal with this dog.
Yeah, I love the caption box. And in the lobby of hell.
In the lobby of hell. Oh, that's great.
That's great.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. That's a fantastic bit. And then, you know, of course, the Micronauts can't follow the dog because they would be spotted by the humans. So they have to find a different way in. And they do so by coming upon this grate this air vent, and Microtron, you know, unscrews the rivets there, allowing access of the astro station to actually access this air vent. And yeah. then some of them go, I mean, obviously Commander Rand's trying to find a different form of entry, but he sends Microtron and a Croyer to explore the air vents and track down Bug. And that's when we get our first glimpse through the eyes of Bug of the Prometheus mm-hmm. pit. Now, this is a spectacular lab, right, Billy? As labs go, yeah. this is amazing. Mm-hmm. And then we get this yep. eerie scene, I think it's on page 14, of these dead Micronauts in these... in these, you know, like tubes or
almost like, yeah, almost like test tube type looking things. Yeah.
Yeah. And they've been dissected, but now they're preserved by Professor Prometheus, who's this African-American guy, but he's very sinister. As soon as he hears that, you know, Steve has got a, you know, selection of these dead Micronauts, he's interested, but not as interested as he would be once he hears that Steve has actually met live Micronauts who are still out there, because Steve drops the name of Commander Ran, and Philip Prometheus just goes absolutely crazy. He grabs Steve and becomes violent with the boy and says, "Commander Ran, who is this Commander Ran? Who is he?" And he grabs the boy, and then, of course, the dad steps in, right? Ray yeah. Coffin says, "Hey, you're upsetting my son." And now he realizes Professor Prometheus is deranged. And Bug, he's obviously protective of the boy. With his rocket lance, he's positioning himself above Professor Prometheus in case he hurts the boy. Bug's going to intercede, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we get a bit of an origin story here. What do we learn about Professor Prometheus as he, you know, rants and raves here, holding the boy?
Yeah, well, he says about being on like a orbiting space station, what does he call it, Star Lab, you yeah. know, he was saying about how he got into an accident there, and then, you know, they use this kind of crazy machine on him and like almost like rebuilt him like a cyborg, and then he's like starts to get like murderous, and he grabs Steve there by the neck and
starts strangling him. Yeah,
yeah, he starts choking the crap out of him, and that's when his dad tries to interject, that we see these, you know, guards or, you know, attendants or whatever they're supposed to be, you know, that they're not human either. It was really creepy.
Yeah, they're automatons created by, almost like life model decoys or something, created here by Professor Prometheus. And Professor Prometheus appears to be a robotic genius because he designed parts of Starlab. So when he was involved in an accident in space, his robotic machines automatically, you know, initiated a medical procedure. But since he was... well, they couldn't save his life. They opted for turning him into a cyborg instead, these machines that he created.
So yeah.
He's a robotic genius, but he also, you know, manages to, you know, access the microverse through this second creation of him, which is the Prometheus pit. It's a portal to the microverse, essentially, right, Billy? And yeah. as soon as he, you know, well, starts to really choke... I mean, he's been choking him before, but now he's decided he's going to choke the life out of poor little Steve Coffin. Bug leaps to the rescue, and with his rocket lance, he slashes this furrow through, you know, what, his brow and his eye. This is of Professor Prometheus, right? Injuring him. And yeah. then now Professor Prometheus is... this is his first glimpse of a Micronaut, a living Micronaut, we should say, right? And, mm-hmm. You know, Ray thanks Bug... he says, or Steve thanks Bug. He says, "I never thought I'd see you again." And Bug says, "There's no such tick thing as never, kiddo." I love Bug, right? He's yeah. great. He's sort of the Nightcrawler of the Micronauts, I think, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then, yeah, I'm alive. Tick, tick, angry, goggle eye. He calls him goggle eye. Now he's showing his Spider-Man chops, you know, like insulting. And he's got these witty, witty... comments during battle. "Touch that kid again yeah. and I'll tick tick gut you."
mm-hmm.
It's great. So Billy, then we cut yeah. to the microverse, man. What's happening over
oh,
there? Jeez,
this is really creepy. This so yeah, you like got
Nazi
Baron Karzai
concentration camp level creepy, right?
It is. That's a spot on excellent comparison, because you have these people being lined up, you know, and they're walking down this ramp into this, you know, it's portrayed as black, but who knows if that's just, you know, the coloring choice they had there, just, you know, whatever. You know, they're getting stripped naked and being marched into there with these guards with, you know, weapons, you know, telling them to move it. And they're basically being deloused, you know, as the one woman says, or the one guy says. And a woman says, they strip our pride from us as easily as they strip our clothes. And they said, you know, that they're basically doing that to get them ready for their fodder for the body banks. It's gross, but it's creepy, too. Oof,
it's really creepy. It's got this weird connotation to it that you don't want to explore to the fullest. Because after all, Billy, they're being harvested, these people, for, you know, their organs, for their bodies, for the rich, essentially. And and Lady Slug, one of the great beauties of the Microverse, on par with marionette, sometimes even, you know, more beautiful, portrayed as more beautiful than she is now the target here. Because what happens while, you know, Baron Karza shows off his magnificent empire to the Duchess Belladonna, this aged woman coming for her new body, which she's had on reserve for a while. Now Baron Karza, he hasn't managed to secure a body yet for her. And then Prince Argon has somehow managed to free himself because he's newly been turned into a centaur by Baron Karza, and he's now, you know, intent on wreaking havoc and just taking as many dog soldiers and Karza's cronies with him. He shows up, somehow managed to get a blaster and starts blasting and killing people left and right. And then Slug, of course, recognizes him as her love. They had a relationship. But Baron Karza allows this just as a display for the newly captured rebels to show how futile any escape attempt is. What does he do to poor Argon?
Oh, he blasts him right in the face, and it almost looks like he blows his head off. It's a really creepy panel. And I mean, the way Golden does it, too, is, you know, it's a six-panel page, and the top two panels, the far right one, it shows Baron Karza blasting with this, like, laser heat vision. And the blast goes down into the next panel to show him getting zapped. And, oh, it's crazy good. It's incredible.
I mean, the super science of Baron Karza renders him almost invincible. I mean, he's got this armor that he created that he constantly wears. And he's continuously renewing himself through the body banks as well. Then he's got this personalized force shield. He's almost like Lex Luthor in the Bronze Age when Lex developed that armor of his that was put him on par with Superman. And then, of course, Tony Stark, you can compare it to Iron Man too. But he's more than that. You know, he's a sci-fi villain on another level. And he blasts. It's almost like with these dark side like Omni Beams or Omega Beams, I should say. He blasts poor Aragorn. And Prince Argon, sorry. I keep messing up his name with Aragorn from Lord of the Rings. Prince Argon. I just have to think about an element, the chemical element argon. That's what he's named after. So he leaves him smoking, unconscious, and his entire head is smoking with his energy effect that he was blasted with. It almost looked like his face has been immolated, and that causes Lady Slug to reveal herself. You know, she's the only one from the crowd not cowed by the display of power. She attacks the dog soldiers, and they block her path. And then Baron Karza's attention is on Slug, and she says, "I found you the perfect body, Belladonna." And they say, "Take her away." And poor Slug is now in for, well, she's it's going to be hell for her because her body's going to be stolen from her and given to the Duchess Belladonna. And then, you know, we cut back to Project Prometheus in the bowels of hell. What happens there, Billy? Muffin shows up.
The dog comes blasting in and kind of disrupts things. And then, of course, the other Micronauts are there, too. So, you know, they kind of put a stop to things. But this is the first time we've seen anyone, you know, on Earth, you know, act like they have any knowledge of the Microverse or anything like that. So, you know, this is... You know, this Dr. Prometheus, he's, you know, like we said earlier, he has these little test tubes that has some of them in it already. So it's really starting to get interesting here, you know, that he knows about it. And then he's like, I must get to the Microverse. So he really wants to get there.
Yeah, exactly. That's his goal. And he needs to breach the space wall, which is death for those who've tried so far. I mean, the only people who've managed to breach the space wall are the Micronauts in the Endeavor. And of course... Prince Shaitan, who who followed them through the breach. And now, you know, the Prometheus pit allows that. It allows for a spaceful breach, but he's yet to test it. He has to make sure it's safe, and to do that, he needs living Micronauts. And he's got them now. And then, you know, during the fight here between the Micronauts and Professor Prometheus's robots, whom Croyer takes out spectacularly, right? He, with his energy sword, he smashes through the wall, arrives in the nick of time, slashes open the back of one of these robots. And then Microtron comes to the rescue of Ray Coffin, or Steve Coffin. He's falling into the pit, right? And Microtron anchors himself and extends this. It seems all the robots from the Microverse can do that. We've seen Biotron do that earlier. He sort of telescopes his legs, right, to reach a table. And the same is done here by Microtron. He telescopes one of his arms, grabs onto Steve's pants leg, and has enough strength to pull this giant kid out of the Prometheus pit. And then,
yeah, I don't know. I don't know if we've mentioned that before or not, but just because they're, you know, tiny compared to, like, you know, people walking around on Earth, they still have, like, proportional strength, you know, almost like a spider or an ant does.
Yeah, they do. They're definitely much stronger than a human would be at that size, you know, and that's definitely, well, I mean, in a Croyer's case, it's like his natural strength, you know, being amplified, you know, so it's insanely strong in some of their cases, but definitely in Microtron's case, you can see this little robot being able to carry this immense weight. Definitely proportional strength there. But, you know, then we see this great panel from Golden on page 27. The face of... as soon as Commander Rand blasts through the skylight there, we see this half robot, half-human face of this deranged Professor Prometheus, right? And that reminds me of that... I don't know if you ever read the Legion of Superheroes comics featuring the Fatal Five, Billy. You know, over at DC. Okay, the greatest, or, well, in my mind at least, their greatest villains, it's not the Time Trapper, it's not Mordru the Sorcerer, it's the Fatal Five. Even the Legion of Supervillains pale against these five, and one of them is a half-cyborg, half-human called Therok. Every time I saw Professor Prometheus in the Micronauts comics, it made me think of Therok, this half-human, half-cyborg villain from the 30th century in DC who fought the Legion. I mean, he's a scary-ass villain because of this... you know, it's kind of like Cyborg from the Teen Titans, but turned evil.
You know, you know what it reminds me of? And maybe I'm off base here, but like you said, that face, back on page 19, when it shows the Duchess, you know, her face, you know, it shows a close-up of her face. And then on this very last page, page 30... you know, the sun's face right in the middle there, like they're kind of like features and eyes and stuff like that are a little exaggerated. It reminds me, I don't know if you're, you know, a big fan of anime, you know, you're over in Asia there, so you probably see that kind of stuff all the time, but like a Miyazaki, you know, animated character, like, you know, from like Howl's Moving Castle or something like that, like, you know, the faces of the you know, people were like all exaggerated and kind of like almost like a little bloated or chunky like that. Kind of reminds me of that.
Yeah, it does have a little bit of that art style in there. You're right. I'm not saying it's full manga art, no. but it's definitely more hearkening back to some anime you would see, especially like, maybe not even Miyazaki, but yeah, Miyazaki too, but like you would say, see on Akira. You know, like, do you remember, you must have seen the Akira movie, right, Billy, from the 80s?
I've seen advertisements for it, yeah.
Oh, you've never seen it? Oh, you gotta see it, dude.
I haven't, no.
You gotta see it. This is very Akira-like, you know, especially at the end when Tetsuo sort of turns himself into a cyborg briefly there. Yeah. But yeah, it's got some Miyazaki too, you know, from some of Miyazaki's lesser known films, you know, maybe Castle in the Sky or, you know, what's that one with the giant robot? I forgot. It's not a giant robot, not like the Iron Giant, but this one, Laputa, I think. Laputa is called. And, definitely has that kind of animation feel to it. You're right. And it's very organic plus metallic looking. Yeah. And that's what causes this contrast that leads you to think about horror. And then, you know, of course, Commander Rand with his blaster, he just blasts Prometheus, Philip Prometheus, into the Prometheus pit, but not before, because, you know, of course, Ray Coffin, he wants to make sure his son is safe. So he tackles Prometheus, But he doesn't think at that time, because he plunges into the pit with Professor Prometheus. So now Steve Coffin's dad and Professor Prometheus are lost in the Prometheus pit. And we can, from what Commander Rand says, we can see that they're shrinking and disappearing.
Yeah.
So they're lost in the microverse, and now the killer robots are still out for blood here.
Mm-hmm.
Following
the
final directive of their creator, Prometheus. And then we say, next issue, The Great Escapes. So that's, again, The Great Escape.
Be here for both of them.
Yeah, I mean, we got Dog Day Afternoon, you know, in the ROM comic, and now we've got The Great Escape. But The Great Escapes here, wow, they really love to reference the movies of the time.
Yeah, or which maybe, is cool. I like it.
Just a little bit after The Great Escape, though. But yeah, it's amazing. So yeah, this is definitely the best Micronauts issue to date, right, Billy? You and I have both mentioned
that.
Absolutely. I liked it.
Absolutely. Not even a question. Yep.
Yeah, so we'll be continuing with Micronauts for a while as well as ROM. You know, we won't be changing that up, but we will eventually. But we're definitely gonna have a new licensed comic next time around in November for you patrons out there, and it'll be a surprise. We know you'll like it. I'm pretty sure. But Billy, let's talk favorite covers and favorite issues. We'll get to the favorite covers first. Which one did you like more than the rest?
So for me, favorite cover is without a doubt Micronauts. You know, I kind of already gave that away, saying that I'd love to see a signature on this one. So I got to go with Micronauts. It's very creepy. I love it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I love the cover to Godzilla, but Micronauts is hands down the best. It just has to be because, you know, the ROM cover is my least favorite, I'm sorry to say, by Al Milgram there, because it's just it's not a bad cover at all. It's just it's not as special as the other two.
Yeah, it's okay.
It's okay. Yeah. And so I agree with you there. Okay, so we're in full agreement on the best cover. Now, which issue is your favorite?
It's razor close, but it's definitely ROM. Like, I would give ROM a 5 out of 5, and Godzilla and Micronauts would be like 4 or 4.5 out of 5. It's super close, but I would still say ROM. I enjoyed a little bit more.
Yeah. I give Micronauts, I mean, even though it's a great issue, I still give it just a 3.5 out of 5 for Micronauts. Previous Micronauts issue would be a 3 or even a 2.5, but this is a 3.5 for me. The ROM issue and the Godzilla issue, I would give a 5 out of 5 for both, but I'm going to pick Godzilla. Because Godzilla is so full of wackiness. You've got the dialogue of Dum Dum Dugan, then you've got the amazing fight scene between Gabriel Jones and Dr. Demonicus and his goon squad, and then you've got Godzilla ripping apart these kaiju, and then you've got the war between the demon soldiers and S.H.I.E.L.D. and the Eskimos. And then you've got this fantastic ending where Godzilla saves the life of Dum Dum before, you know, heading off into the ocean onto the next adventure. I mean, compared to that, ROM is still legitimately great because of the art, you know, working and the writing and, you know, this demon battle that he has in this house. Which is something totally unexpected. Plus, you've still got the intrigue of the Dire Wraiths, too. And the horror of Archie Stryker. All of that works really well. But just because this is our farewell to Godzilla for now, and because we ended it on such a strong issue with this giant kaiju battle, and every single death in that comic is spectacular. Right, Billy, with Godzilla just, you know, he's just he's just very creative in killing these other rival kaiju.
Yeah.
And then the fall of Dr. Demonicus, that just worked for me, so I'm going to have to give it to Godzilla here. So that brings us to an end of another House of Licensed Ideas. I hope you enjoyed it, patrons, and thanks again for supporting us. We really appreciate it. Check out our recent episode of Into the Weird, where we thank Gord Talton, you know, who runs the Prairie Justice Greg Sanders Vigilante podcast, our newest patron. And, of course, we thank the rest of you guys as well. Without you, we wouldn't be here. And we wouldn't be having so much fun.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we're remiss in mentioning Steve Cronin as well, who was a very recent, around the same time as Gord Talton,
right,
too.
Right. He was a just new before Gord, right? Wasn't he? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm busy cobbling together something for them. You know, obviously Steve Cronin, I think he's a, if I'm not mistaken, Billy, which tier did he sign up for? You're the one running the patron tier, so yeah, I don't have access to that.
He was the $5 a month.
Yeah. So I'm busy cobbling together some thank yous for them. You know, I've already got given Gort the thank you, and then I'm also gonna feature Steve on our next issue of Into the Weird. And really, guys, we appreciate everything you're doing for us financially. And that also, you know, obviously motivates us to keep providing better and better content. So we love you guys. So thanks for that. And now that we're heading into Halloween, expect some more horror-related things to appear. Maybe not on the Patreon, but definitely in terms of the regular Into the Weird cast. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so it's going to be fun, right, Billy? Heading into Halloween. Woohoo!
Can't wait.
All right. Well, with that, we're going to say goodbye. Just like Godzilla, heading off to calmer waters here. You and I are doing the same, Billy, with a final roar or hurrah or screonk or whatever sound you want to use the lettering for. That's what we're using to say goodbye for this issue. Take care of yourself, patrons.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.